See? We told you Carl Kirkwood was special. Welcome back to Motorsport 101. Welcome to episode 435 of Motorsport 101. I'm your friendly neighborhood host, Dre Harrison. And wow, IndyCar was back at Long Beach this weekend for a hectic race's worth of action. And we are celebrating a brand new winner in the IndyCar series. And his name is King Kyle Kirkwood. Just like all the people predicted out there. I mean, he was 20-1 to win this race going into the weekend. So that was a big upset win for us this time around in IndyCar. But we'll get into that in a little bit because we actually have a special guest with us on this edition of the show. We'll get into that in just a minute. But first up, RJ O'Connell, how's it going, man?
I give our newest IndyCar race winner a big thumbs up. Just like the one that he gave David Malukas in practice before the weekend really kicked off. A big thumbs up. That's got to be his new victory celebration. I think he's got to make it like his versions of Sebastian Vettel's thinger. He's got to give it the big thumbs up.
The most sarcastic pointing thumbs up I think I've ever heard in my life.
It's got the big like vibe of the Curtis Mayfield move on up thing where something terrible's about to happen, but then they reverse it and it comes on and says, "It's fine."
It's all good. It's all good. But yeah, we'll get into some of that action in a minute. But we want to introduce our special guest. She is from Queen's Design. She's driver and illustrator for them, a very prominent esports team and an important stride in terms of diversity. Welcome to the Motorsport 101, Ruby Acosta. Hello.
Hi. Hi, everybody. Thank you for having me on. This is really special for me. My first podcast, actually.
Oh my gosh, wow.
Is this your first ever podcast?
Yeah, it is.
I'm so sorry you're stuck with us.
It's okay.
But no, pleasure to have you on, Ruby. And, you know, we wanted to talk, we one episode ago, you probably haven't heard it yet because we really just put it up on Early Access yesterday. We just finished it yesterday, but we talked about MotoGP and the unfortunate nature of having a transphobic woman sing the national anthem, which was annoying as shit. Listen to the end of that episode if you want to hear more of my thoughts on that. But we are firm believers in practicing what we preach and paying it forward. And I wanted to give you, Ruby, the platform to be able to talk about Queen's Design. Again, props to RJ for coming up with the great idea to have you on as a guest. But speak your truth, Ruby. Tell the good people out there about Queen's Design and the mission of the project.
Yeah, well, Queen's Design, we started this project last year in January, and we've gone pretty far since then. Our mission is to give LGBTQ plus people a space in sim racing esports and a space in sim racing in general, because a lot like real motorsport, sim racing in itself is very male dominated, and it's very sort of how do you say it in English? There's like a bit of machismo in it as well.
Oh, just a little bit.
Yeah,
you know, it's homogenous.
Yes, it is very homogenous and very not old people oriented, old man oriented, but it's the kind of old man oriented where on the forum signatures, I see a lot, "wife to make me coffee" in the middle of like their PC specs and stuff. So we're trying to sort of change that and bring awareness that yes, there are people like us in sim racing. There's a lot, and there's a lot more than people think. And we want to sort of help them sort of not feel scared or afraid to sort of show themselves and be a part of the community. And I think so far we've done a great job. A lot of people have come up to us and thanked us for what we do, even if we feel like it isn't much in the grand scheme of things. There are a few people who actually have come up to us and thank us for, you know, being out here and sort of unapologetically being ourselves in a way.
Absolutely. I mean, give us a little humble brag, Ruby. Like, tell us how far you've come already. I mean, because I know it seems like it's a small, humble beginning, but I'm I'm sure you've already done a lot and made an impact. Clearly, people are coming up to you and recognizing how important your role is in the world of esports and beyond.
Yeah, I mean, just recently, I feel like I think a month ago, a month or two ago, we finished our first season in VCO, Low Fuel Motorsport Flexstream. VCO is esports are a big organization in the esports sim racing world. They do they hold the VCO Esports World Cup along with a lot of other iRacing things, and we were participating in that alongside big teams, some big controversial teams like Williams Esports. I don't know if like you've gone over a lot of their controversy, but they're very big team. Regardless, we've gone up against Unicorns of Love, BS Competition, BS Plus Competition, and we were sort of underdogs because we had two pro drivers, and technically I and April Carlsvard, another member of the team, we are admittedly not up to the pro level of a lot of other drivers there, so we were sort of the underdogs, and we managed to finish I think every race, and that is already a huge achievement for us, since it was it's basically a trial by fire for me and April, and I'm so glad that we were able to sort of survive that, because top level sim racing is very, very unforgiving and very cutthroat. And for me personally, I am a Screen to Speed finalist. I went to Las Vegas last month, and
this is so cool. Tell us a little bit about like Screen to Speed, what that is, and just like the whole experience of going from qualifying to being invited out to Las Vegas with so many of your peers for a chance to drive for real.
Yeah, like at first it didn't really register. I feel like during the qualifying hot lapping session, it just felt like any other competition. And then all of a sudden, when I started driving to Vegas, since I live close by, I live in Los Angeles, so I didn't really have to fly there. But when I got my own hotel room and I met everybody, it started sort of hitting how important it was that like a lot of like really prominent people in sim racing and just racing in general. I know Steffi Bao is really successful in the world of motocross. Sabre Cook was there as well, and I was able to talk to her. And Victoria Thomas of Kelly Moss was there, and I've got the chance to meet her recently in Long Beach again, and it was very humbling. And not humbling, it was very I felt very privileged for it. And like the moment that everything sort of came together and all of these people sort of like made this come to life, yeah, it was pretty big to have us at all like because I feel like I'm not a very big time esports racer. I feel like I'm sort of up and coming. So to have that sort of spotlight was just really surreal. And it was like the first time I ever felt like, wow, I'm actually doing something kind of pretty big.
Oh, that's astonishing. And like, it adds to like a list of like, as you mentioned, this is an upstart team, but you know, the whole organization is racking up pretty big levels, pretty big successes, and has success on their resume. Anor Rose, the team principal, the team leader, has had success in SRO esports sanctioned events. Mia Rose actually had, wasn't she in Virtual Le Mans Cup?
She won a Virtual Le Mans Cup race against Sean Arnold and a few other big esports drivers. And I think she finished third overall in the point standing. So that is
incredible.
A massive accomplishment.
Yeah. Don't get it twisted if you're listening out there. These girls can drive. They can drive really, really fast. And because you're invested in it, I guess I've come to know you enough because, you know, we go back a bit. But people who know that you feel very strongly about the state of sim racing in general.
Definitely. Just,
and it's come up because there's been video essays about the state of racing games in general and how they've kind of grown further away from what we've grown up with as children of anywhere from ets to ets years of age. So Ruby, I want to ask, how do you think sim racing simulators, racing games, how could they be better than what they are now?
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting question to ask, because like I've been sort of like daydreaming about how a perfect game could, you know, like as usual, I daydream a lot about how a perfect game could sort of be, like how a perfect sim racing game can be. I feel like a lot of the time, a lot of these sim racing developers are sort of pursuing this endless science project of a game rather than like just an actual video game. It's they're more like making a software rather than something to enjoy. And I think a lot of the emphasis on esports recently has sort of, it's funny because I am sort of involved in esports, but it's sort of, I'm sort of being self-aware to a point where I feel like the rest of the audience, the people who just want to sort of immerse themselves and like be like their favorite driver, like you said before in the, like in the intro, Kyle Kirkwood, they want to like imitate Kyle Kirkwood and they want to be like, they want to sort of immerse themselves and like how, feel like how it is to be like an IndyCar driver, like or whatever sort of driver. And I feel like very few games get that right. The Formula One series, there's a great career mode in there, despite its many setbacks recently. I feel like that's the only game as of recent that actually has you feel like you're actually immersed in the whole sport. And like a lot of sim racing games really don't get that, and they're more focused on just they're not, they don't even have the full flag rules and everything. It's so like, I feel like they are missing the make-believe part of it, which is funny to me in general, because I feel like, how can I say this? It sounds ridiculous, but like, I feel like it could benefit more from the role-playing aspect rather than just the actual simulation aspect.
I find it ironic in that sense that sim racing, which many people think is all about trying to create as realistic and as accurate an experience of driving the real cars, you say is missing a little bit of make-believe. That's actually quite an interesting perspective.
Yeah, because you can sort of you could sort of see even iRacing, where a lot of it's just the results and the rating, iRating, and all of this, and getting the fastest lap and hot lapping. But everybody's sort of like so invested in their iRating that they forget why they're racing in the first place, which is to sort of like pretend that they're a race car driver for a day and pretend with other people. And I feel like people are sort of ashamed of doing that because it seems embarrassing, I guess. It seems like, you know, it seems not embarrassing, but it seems unnecessary, which is very strange, because when you play other games like flight simulators, you pretend to put passengers on your plane, you do all the taxiing and all of that, and like, or if you're doing a truck simulator, you pretend to sort of unload your cargo, and it's sim racing.
You can just kind of let yourself immerse yourself in being a professional racing driver like you would in any of this other stuff. But I guess in a lot of sim racers, it just becomes a process of like being a slave to the grind.
Yeah. Rise and grind gamers, basically.
Worst kind.
Yeah, it's like it's become more of like CSGO rather than actually an actual simulator, like an actual hobby. Oof.
Okay, that's a very interesting, in other words, it's like we're all taking it almost a little bit too seriously.
Yeah, basically it's like we've treated it as a job rather than a hobby, and so for some people it's a job, and like, yeah, I understand, like it's sort of my job to be an esports racer, but like I feel like not everybody wants to do that because they already have a job and they just want to go home and just pretend they're a race car driver for a day.
Like, oh yeah, Dre, doesn't this get also to the heart of why, like, you're not the hugest, like, hardcore sim racer? Because it feels like, you know, those games do take themselves way too seriously to the point that they stop being enjoyable at times. Like, Ruby is the one person I know, by the way, that will evangelize about the good shit that Project Cars 2 did. And say what you will about how that game was a success or a failure or what, but there are good ideas in it.
Yeah. I mean, personally, I think it's a bit kind of, what's the best way of wording this? it's strange in that as I've played a huge amount of arcade and Simcade style racing games all through the years. That was a huge part of my early life as a content creator. And part of the reason why I dropped playing the F1 games every year and playing the MotoGP games every year was because their handling models had stopped being as fun. And I still, part of me thinks they were catering more towards the esports crowd. And that is something that's put me right off of many of these Simcade sort of accessible racing games. Because I know there's a big gap between a F1 2022 and an iRacing, right? Oh, but there certainly was like 5 or 6 years ago. But now it's... the lines are getting blurry between those sorts of franchises. And I think to people like me that just want to sit down and play a racing game casually, there's less of that out there.
You know, it's funny you say that because I feel like games are actually getting harder again instead of actually more realistic. Because, right. Yeah, because like... I recall people saying back in the day, as like in the days before GTR2, like games like F1 Challenge or Grand Prix Legends, where the games were harder just because they thought that was more realistic. And it turns out that cars aren't actually hard to drive. They're just sort of like, you know, they take practice like anything else, but in the end, they're made to go fast, not to kill you. I mean,
right.
So, like, I feel like a lot of these titles coming out, like, becoming harder and harder, I feel like they're catering more towards what the esports people say they want instead of what is actually, you know, realistic or actually enjoyable, which has been a big problem, I feel like, in a lot of these sim racing titles, a lot of days, because they take input from esports racers rather than taking input from their own experience and such. It's kind of like the Halo problem. I remember... Mm. It's kind of like the FPS shooter kind of problem, where they take suggestions from actual esports players rather than what actual players want, which, you know, just creates this whole sort of mess.
Yeah, I remember when people were jumping up and down when Cody's brought on David Greco to help out with their handling model, and I was sitting there going, I don't think you want this as much as you think you do. Not because I don't respect David, of course I do. I watched him in FSR years ago, and I know he's a damn good racing driver, but I don't think your casual audience wants to be playing a game that's more like a sim. I think people are going to buy it and they're going to get put off by that, because... that sort of style of model, I don't think is as fun as an accessible to the average Joe like me, or compared to someone that maybe has esports aspirations, which is still a very small percentage of your overall market.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. That's what people don't understand, is that we are actually just a small facet of sim racing in general. And I wish big investors would realize that, you know, we're not the only ones in a room. And like, at the end of the day, I also want to enjoy these games as games, because I love racing and I love sim racing. It's just that I don't want to do this all the time, but I feel like that's enough of me complaining.
I mean, let's talk about something on the brighter end of things. I mean, you were one of the people that went to the Long Beach Grand Prix in person this past weekend. How was it?
Oh, it was a lot of fun. I've been going since 2016, so pretty recent, actually. I've not been to a Grand Prix until like the end of high school, and as always, it is just a magical experience, and this year was just even better. I got invited out to check out like a sort of backstage experience by some people like Kelly Moss, I've been connected to via Screen to Speed, as I said before, and I just felt so privileged, and everybody at Kelly Moss was so nice and everything, but oh my gosh, every year I go to Long Beach, it is just magical.
Awesome, awesome. And in regards to IndyCar events that aren't the 500, how does an event like Long Beach succeed in terms of the fan experience that other events seem to fail? Because we just had Texas about 2 weeks ago now, and Texas was largely panned despite it having a fantastic race. And obviously people were jumping up and down about how great a race it was, and rightly so. I know there was a lot of people that had been in the area or who lived in the area who maybe went down to the race, had friends who went down, and actually criticize the fan experience. So, so what do you think Long Beach is doing right, Ruby?
Well, I have not been to Texas, but I have been to Auto Club for NASCAR races before, and like, I feel like, that's a tough question because like, there's definitely something that I feel like is more magical about Long Beach rather than Auto Club itself, like or Texas, as you say, and like, I feel like it's just. Well, Long Beach has an advantage where it's an actual street circuit. So, like, there's just a lot more of the atmosphere. There's a lot, it feels a lot more, it feels a lot closer to the heart of Long Beach, the heart of a city, a heart of a community. So, you get to see a lot more people and a lot more sort of people of different backgrounds, people who are just casual fans or people just looking to have a good time. And there's a lot, definitely a lot more of those kind of experiences there at Long Beach than I would say at a, sort of dedicated racetrack, because it's a fan experience that's more catered towards everybody instead of just a race fan. But also I feel like it has a lot to do with just how sort of accessible everything is, because IMSA comes to the same weekend and everything, and like whenever I'm in the IMSA paddock, everything feels very comfy, very sort of homey, and you could sort of just talk to drivers, talk to team members, and they talk back to you, and you know, you can have some casual small talk, you can ask questions and they answer stuff. And I feel like with like dedicated IndyCar events, like you can have the same experience, but I feel like everybody is sort of like taking it more seriously, and like it's more it's definitely more focused, and that's not a bad thing. I feel like people like complain about the new Iowa sort of weekend because there's like a concert, like there's a concert that nobody's gonna go to or nobody's gonna specifically go to Iowa for. But I feel like a lot of what Long Beach has going for it is that it's just Long Beach, you know, it's a lot more natural. It has a lot more history rather than just Texas. It's just kind of there.
It feels like. It feels like a permanent surrogate trying to hold like a date just for the sake of like, we've got a date on the calendar. Let's just see how it kicks off. And if people want to come by and see it, you know, they'll come by and see it, you know. But Long Beach had record attendance this weekend, and that's really, really awesome. And look, we can rehash our whole discussion, maybe not in front of guests about, you know, obviously, IndyCar is having problems getting people to watch on streaming or television events that are not the Indianapolis 500, but it does go to show like there are individual events that can succeed in bringing people out. Yes, Long Beach does have a built-in advantage, is that it's right in the city. It's hard to avoid it, but
I live 10 minutes across from the event, so that's another advantage I have.
That helps. That certainly helps. But it is actually good to hear that Long Beach had a record crowd, because I've been very critical about the way IndyCar promotes itself. And you know, I was quite down on Texas, despite it being a great race, that, you know, there were a lot of pissing contests about how it was hosting races. The TV ratings weren't great, and you know, the fan turnout wasn't great. You could see a lot of empty seats in the pictures of the event itself. So it's actually great to hear that Long Beach seems to be, seems to be going to step in the right direction.
And considering it's post-COVID too,
Don't
get me wrong, we are not post-COVID, but like, we are post the onset of the pandemic and everything having to stop for a while. So that even helps. So we have everything in place and people are coming out to see two awesome races. Man, I cannot believe Ricky Taylor did that in the last lap. I'm trying to figure out what I can't believe less. Ricky Taylor throwing the race away with two laps left with plenty of time to make a move around that Porsche 963, or Sebastian Bourdais' race lasting 15 seconds. He can drive the track into sleep.
Toss a coin. I've never figured I'd ever see Sebastian Bourdais, one of the great drivers of the 21st century, spin out essentially in a straight line and his race end in 15 seconds. I'm startled.
Yeah, my father next to me, he is a big Bourdais supporter, and he couldn't believe it either. Like, he just was sort of broken for the whole race until again, the last lap, and he was just, he just could not believe, I don't know, well, not the last lap, but it's just, we couldn't, we both could not believe what was going on in front of us, I think was the thing. Like, it was just a wild Saturday.
I also love that when Ricky Taylor hit the wall at the end, they had Matthew Jaminet's radio going, and apparently Jaminet said, if he makes that corner, that's mad impressive. Turns out he didn't make the corner. That didn't go well for him. But that was one of the two great races we had at Long Beach this weekend. Should we talk a little bit about the other one?
Oh, I think we should get into the other one. Let's get in the main event, the Acura Grand Prix of Long Beach, right after this.
Andretti are back. From having only one car in the top 10 across the first two rounds of the season, Andretti hit back with a 1-2-4 finish. Sorry, Devlin. At Long Beach. And in the biggest surprise of them all, depending on who you ask, Kyle Kirkwood dominated the race, leading 53 of 85 laps from pole position to take his first series victory, from Romain Grosjean and Marcus Ericsson sharing a podium in third. Colton Herta, by the way, was the other Andretti in fourth, in case you couldn't tell already. Now, we dedicated an entire YouTube special to this man's quality, so it's only fair, knowing that we can give it some humble brag, RJ, of our own. We're going to give Kirkwood some flowers, because that was an incredible performance.
It was. This was not the handiwork of a driver who in 17 races last year crashed out of 7 of them. This is not the handiwork of a driver whose average finish in 20 starts is now a sparkling and pristine, let me check my notes here, 19.3.
Huh.
This looked like the work of a driver who was American Open Wheel Racing's highest touted prospect. There is a reason why we had a YouTube special born out of anxiety whether or not he was going to get a ride. Because let's rewind a bit. Kyle Kirkwood, from 2017 to 2021, participated in the following contests. You have Formula 4 United States, Formula Regional Americas, the first rung of the road to Indy, that's USF 2000, the series that is now called USF Pro 2000, and the series that is now called Indy Next. In four straight seasons, reminder, Indy Next was suspended in 2020 due to the pandemic, he won all 5 of those championships in a span of 4 years, with a whopping 55 wins in 84 races from 2017 to 2021. I am not even including his 4 races in IMSA, which already include multiple race wins, including Petit Le Mans in his class. This looked like a driver that was no longer having to push at the limit to get results out of cut rate equipment and setups, like extracting blood from a stone. Because with all due deference to the lineage of AJ Foyt Racing, this is where they are at right now. They are not at Andretti's level.
No,
he's not having to do that anymore. This is a driver who's confident and comfortable out front. By his own admission, he says, this is a lot easier. This is a lot less stressful than having to fight your way through the pack. I bet you we'll probably get into some of those reasons why in a little bit. He was able to dictate the pace of the race. The only time he wasn't in control was off the second safety car restart. He got pinched behind Agustin Canapino's wounded car, which had contact with Elio Castroneves and the wall. That gave Joseph Newgarden an opportunity to slip on through and lead the middle stint, but Andretti Autosport gave him a perfect strategy and pit stop that allowed him to overcut Newgarden, but then had to spend his entire last stint saving fuel, and he could stay ahead of Romain Grosjean, who settled in second, and all Kirkwood had to do was just do the same things that got him to this stage to begin with, and it worked!
It was bully ball, only without stepping on someone's chest first, Draymond. Look, when I wrote about this on the website, I took more of an emotional, historical deep dive into it, for the reason of this was a really emotional win for Andretti. Like, Michael was in tears during the Victory Lane celebrations. This one clearly meant a lot. This was Andretti's best race result since Mid-Ohio 2020, where they locked out the podium. And even then, it was only kind of a sort of, because Colton was still in a partly owned Harding car at the time. So technically, I guess you could say it was a podium lockout for Andretti. But yeah, it was their best result in a couple of years. And then you look at the way that Andretti has not exactly had an easy time of late, trying and to get into F1. They're struggling with that. Colton Herta's future's been up in the air. His name's been tossed around for multiple F1 seats.
They got a brand new co-owner with endless wells of cash. So, like, we'll pay whatever you asked us to get in on the grid.
Yeah, and the grid was like, no, we don't want you. We like our little cushy franchise model. Thank you very much. You know, they had the big Mid-Ohio blow-up last year that, you know, dragged the entire team into disrepute. Michael Andretti threatening to fight people on a hot mic. They've not had it easy, and Kirkwood's not had it easy. You know, I mean, spending a year at AJ Foyt is... It's a brutal time, and I don't wish it on anybody, because you could tell just by watching him that he was overdriving that car to get any sort of results out of it. And I don't think it's a coincidence he had four or five crashes of his own volition last season. And I was one of these guilty parties that maybe thought that the hype of Kirkwood maybe was a bit overblown. I was wrong. This performance was why everybody was so excited about this guy coming through as a prospect. This was a nearly flawless weekend. Qualified on pole. He pushed Joseph Newgarden. Who bullies Joseph Newgarden on a racetrack? No one. Like, he's Joseph Newgarden. He's arguably the best driver in the whole series. And the way he did it, taking track position, the overcut, holding his nerve with Grosjean, incredible. This was the first real race that I feel like Kogan had a shot to win. And he took it. He was brilliant. I mean, if you get this season, he was turned into a pogo stick in St. Pete and he was driven into by Alex Rossi in Texas. I mean, to come back like that takes real bottle. So props to him. I think he drove magnificently. I mean, Ruby, you got to see him live in person. Like, what did you make of Kirkwood's performance?
Oh, I loved it. I loved every moment of it, actually. I know my dad next to me was sort of like wishing for more action, but like, he's a sort of original NASCAR fan, so you could see how that sort of pans out. But I loved seeing Kirkwood just absolutely come into his own this whole weekend. I was really surprised seeing him like just snipe out that podium that pole position. Like, I was just freaking out in my own sort of Discord chat, like telling people like oh my gosh, Kirkwood got the pole. Like, I was one of the people that didn't believe in Kirkwood. I just felt like Kirkwood was on the same tier as Devlin DeFrancesco, which is really awful to say. Like, but there's been a few you know, duds at Andretti. So I felt like he wasn't anything like special, like at first glance. But you know, Long Beach has completely changed my tune, and now I feel like he is somebody to look out for. And it's amazing what a different car can do. Cause, my driver Sato, over the years, he's been with AJ Foyt, and I know how that could be.
You know what's ironic is that Takuma Sato is part of a short but very fun list of people that won their first race at Long Beach. Sato did it in an AJ Foyt car, and they haven't won since.
But this weekend was the 10th anniversary of AJ Foyt's last win in IndyCar. And yeah, it was this very weekend, 10 years ago, with Takuma Sato in 2013, which kind of says it all. And to double down on your point, Ruby, I'm not saying Devlin's a pay driver hire, but he's had 20 IndyCar starts and he's not cracked the top 11 yet. I mean, It ain't pretty.
Look, at least Andretti were in a position where they could just undo their oversight, if you will. They realized we kind of promoted the wrong guy on merit. Let's undo that. Kirkwood has this big cushy parachute for like half a last season where even if it gets really, really rough at the end, he's still got a guaranteed place. I do like this little parallel. I want to rewind it 25 years ago because this number 27 car had a different owner, Barry Green, and he decided to take a chance on another second-year driver who had all the speed in the world, but just kept making the dumbest mistakes, crashing out of his first race in Miami, crashing behind the safety car in Road America. He qualifies on pole in Toronto, but then he gets taken out in the first corner, and then later in the race, he crashes again. And maybe he knew something that the rest of the people in the paddock didn't when they were thinking, oh my God, why is Barry Green taking a chance on Dario Franchitti? And we all know how he turned out over the years.
Oh yeah, you could certainly, you never quite know. And like I've the more I watch F1, the more I sit back and I go by one of my friend's points. That was Sasha. He might be listening in. Hi, Sasha, if you are. About how we should probably be giving drivers a 3-year berth to really see what makes them tick, rather than being so quick and often so judgmental, because it could be hard.
I feel sorry to interrupt, but I feel like F1 over the years like has really sort of like pushed that mentality. Like Bourdais, another driver we talked about earlier, I feel like you talked about earlier, was one of those drivers who just was sort of pushed off and pushed away, like sort of like put in the trash just for like a few, just like a couple seasons that have not been sort of, you know, the best. So like that's sort of gotten worse now, like especially with the culture of F1 where we see drivers who just don't mature like as fast as we want them, and we just see them just disappear when they have so much potential.
I literally sat down with the man who fired Mick Schumacher about 3 hours ago, so I kind of know how that feels. It's a weird world out there, and I think it's very much a "what have you done for me lately" sort of vibe. And you got rookies that are coming in under immediate pressure because F1's been absolutely spoilt rotten with young talent in the last half decade or so. And now it's like, well, you've got to be great and getting points on debut now. Otherwise, you might be out by some other academy junior, that, you know, next man up, who's barely turned 19 or some crazy shit like that. So it's a very ruthless path, even more so than it was 5 or 10 years ago. And Kirkwood is the walking definition of that. And like I said, first chance he had to win a race in IndyCar, in my opinion, he goes and wins it, which is pretty remarkable stuff all around. We've got to give some credit to Romain Grosjean as well, because I think Grosjean he's had a very, very good season so far. I feel like he's been very hard done by because of the results that tell the full picture, RJ, but he could, maybe should have won in St. Pete. He was running top five in Texas, and he's finally had a result that was probably deserved in second, but it felt for a while like it could be Grosjean's first win.
Romain Grosjean hasn't had a bad race all year. And like, yeah, there's been times where he's been unlucky in the past, but he also had some stinkers last year. Like if you ignore like anything else, any other misfortunes that may have been inflicted upon him by other drivers, he still had some pretty crummy races. But this year, I really think this is the year they finally gets that first IndyCar win. It's just going to be a matter of when, not if, because he's driving in his element at all manner of tracks. It's not just like, we know he can drive around road and street courses. That's kind of his forte. The Texas race in particular really gave me confidence that, like, he can win anywhere.
It's starting to get to that point, certainly. It feels like he can win any given track in any given discipline now. He's certainly developed as an oval racer in the last year. and we knew his street track game was great. We were having a conversation with King last year at this very race that Grosjean might low-key be the leader of this team. And I've gone back and forth on that thought over the last year or so, but there is certainly something to that. I think Grosjean in another world, in an alternate universe, is leading this championship right now.
And he's not too far off, though. I mean, a few more results and he won't be too far off. I mean, Marcus Ericsson, all he has to do is just finish race consistently and keep his head screwed on straight, and he's back in the championship lead, which he is, leading by 15 points.
Can I just say as well, as a side note, can we please stop calling Marcus Ericsson the sneaky Swede? He's not sneaky. He's just good. He's just good now. Like, he's a very, very good IndyCar driver now, and I don't like the fact people keep calling him sneaky, like him winning is meant to be a surprise. He's good enough where it's not a surprise anymore.
Or to that point, you know, just using his 5 years of being the wrong F1 driver at the wrong time as a crutch to beat the series over the head with.
People can't help themselves on Twitter with that. It's so annoying. I mean, I'm sure you've seen it too, Ruby, where it's like, it's constant appendix measuring contests regarding my series is better than your series, and Marcus Ericsson's one of these vocal point people that is used as a yardstick to defend either party.
You know, I can't stand both sides, because it's just like adding to the fire to the flame. That's exactly what they want, and that's exactly what they live for, like, just to troll around. You know, Formula One fans are sort of turning into football fans, like sort of Big Six football fans now. In terms of us, like, fans, social media and such, like what you see with Chelsea and Man United and Man City.
Well, to be fair, Ruby, are you sure you want to be talking about football, given I know you now support Leeds United?
Oh, yeah. I'd rather
Ruby,
not talk...
Ruby, are they going to stay up?
No, I'd rather not talk about that right now. I'd rather talk about motorsport right now, so...
Okay.
That's
okay.
Fair.
Okay, as an aside. Can we talk about your favorite driver? Can we talk about Pato O'Ward?
Let's talk about Pato O'Ward. Well, my father's favorite driver, not my favorite driver, but I mean, I guess it's second since Sato is not at the road courses this year.
That's fair. There was some controversy in this race with Pato O'Ward's driving standards. He made a late lunge on Scott Dixon that put him into the outside wall before the tunnel that led to a caution and Dixon falling into the back of the field. A few laps later, he span across the same curb, nearly wrecking Marcus Ericsson. Pato apologised for the second impact, but not the first on Dixon. Dixon didn't take kindly to the action after eventually DNFing, saying, quote, "It's all gloves off from this point." Scott Dixon's first DNF since Gateway 2021.
Did anything significant that caused Scott Dixon to drop out of that race?
Fireworks, apparently.
He took a fireworks artillery shell to the side pod?
As you do.
Well, this one was more of a figurative, metaphorical fireworks at the side pod, if you will. Pato, you've been great. What happened this weekend, man?
This was a strange one, man, because Pato went into this race as championship leader, was running in the top six again. And straight off the restart, he takes that lunge on Dixon, which we'll get to in a minute. And then the second one is an absolute slam dunk, silly bit of driving. I think that's pretty concrete. Right. Now, how do we feel about the first incident with Dixon? Because I think this is one that's very much a room splitter.
I was actually going through and... Can I call J.R. Hildebrand your colleague now? J.R. Hildebrand did say something poignant on the Race IndyCar podcast, which he co-hosts about it. He said, quote, "Every position has more value basically now than it did 10 years ago or 5 years ago. The difference that I see in terms of the way that the racecraft has evolved is that 10 years ago, it was very rare that you put guys in positions where even if you were going to make the corner, that for sure they wouldn't. That was just kind of generally a no-no, and so it very rarely happened. You would have a Dario Franchitti up in your face after the race if you had done that. And so I think that's what's happened is you have a younger crop of drivers that didn't really grow up with that being the case. They're just hammering for every position. They're running qualifying laps everywhere, every lap of the race. Now, I'm not going to put this all on just like the young kids have no respect, because I generally think the young drivers race each other with as much respect as their more experienced and tenured counterparts give them and have the leverage to give them, which then ties into a point we had about St. Petersburg, was that race director Kyle Novak, head stewards Ari Leyendijk, Max Pappas, both winners in your own right. I don't want to say that you should take out good, hard racing. I'm not saying that there shouldn't be like incidental content for positions. You know, it happens sometimes, but you kind of gotten too far in the other direction. You know, it's become almost like what people expect out of NASCAR, British touring cars. Now, drivers can just lean on each other, turn with eight wheels instead of four, and whatever happens to the other driver, not my problem.
I mean, I'd love to hear your perspective on this, Ruby, because obviously you sim race. I'm sure you've been in many a heated wheel-to-wheel confrontation. How did you feel about it?
Well, it's hard to say because, like, on one hand, I feel like it's like, you know, he's got to go for it. Like, everybody, you know, it's not a charity. It's a real sporting event. Like, there's competition. There's, like, every point matters on the line. And, you know, if you go for it, you go for it. I mean, I have a bit of bias, of course. Like I said before, my favorite driver in IndyCar was Sato. So that has a lot of influence on it. But also at the same time, I feel like because of they repaved that section, I remember talking to somebody in the IMSA paddock, one of the Inception drivers, was that I heard him say that there's so much more, there's just so much grip where they repaved it in front of the convention center that you can make dives and everything. It just feels like, you know, it gives, and like with these drivers having, like nowadays, having more confidence, like, you know, why not do that? Like, why not just dive all the way from Catalina Island into that corner and just like hope it sticks? And like, it's just a perfect storm of situations. Like, you know, Pato is, because I feel like Pato has not had the best of luck here at Long Beach. I remember him not really having such great races the past few years I've been watching.
Lost that title to Sider when Ed Jones took him out a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I was right there to see it in front of me. And I feel like there's a lot of that frustration sort of like brewing over, especially when he was the fastest car like coming into the fast six, and you know, just not the pace just was not there for the actual sort of pole time. It's just,
why did he burn that extra set of like sticker tires during qualifying? That was one that like I know we've been kind of cold on James Hinchcliffe lately, but he was right. You know, he could have saved that set of tires for the fast six.
Yeah, and
he wouldn't be in this position.
Yeah, so like I feel like all this sort of like, I feel like, and I do understand Scott Dixon, because like I said, he just dived all the way that all like. And that's kind of like a move that you would not have done in past years. But I don't know how to feel about it. I feel like it's just a racing incident. And, you know, Dixon is inclined to feel whatever he wants to feel like. And, you know, Pato doesn't have to apologize. So, I mean, it just... But I feel like this is what IndyCar needs in a way. It needs this sort of tension. It needs this sort of these sort of storylines. Like, like, I don't want needless drama, but I feel like we need these sort of, like, these sorts of, like, not rivalries, but we need this sort of history between drivers. And, like, that's just what that
need
just,
a little bit of needle.
Yeah.
I like a little bit of needle.
A little bit of beef is fun on the palate. So I've always said this. And look, I'm the definition of I think sports fights are great, personally. So I am all for some tension. And look, I was out here cracking jokes during the live broadcast all the way through. I was saying that Pato O'Ward doing an interview in front of an armed posse I thought was funny. There was about 50 fans behind him, all wanting a selfie, an autograph, and a high five, because Pato, I think, is rapidly becoming the most popular driver in the whole series.
Oh, definitely. You could see in Long Beach, I don't know if it's because we're I mean, because there's a lot of Hispanic people and Latino people here, but everybody had a Pato shirt on, or a Pato hat, or anything. Pato.
Interesting. Yeah, there you go. Like, it came off that way on TV, certainly, so I'm not surprised that's been doubled down on the track, because my man is drawing fans. The Hispanics love this dude.
It's like Asian and understandably. Back in the day.
IndyCar, Mexico City race. I don't care how much money it takes to have, make that
shit
happen. Exactly.
Do it yesterday. But yeah, I was going to say, like, that was funny. Part of me still thinks it's armed security in case Emma Davies Dixon comes up with a shovel. But I also...
I have no problems with Scott Dixon himself. The worst thing he's ever done, apart from beating my favorite driver in a tiebreak in 2015, was just being a guy who wins all the time while being just so insufferably nice and mild-mannered. To the point that people think he's like the walking definition of NyQuil sleepy time chicken that puts on a racing helmet and puts on his gloves every day. People cannot stand how consistently dominant he is.
Kind of like Jimmy Johnson effect.
Oh, God, yeah. Like, and I know Jimmy got nicknamed Vanilla for a while for years for that very reason. Dixon's a little bit like that. I think James Hinchcliffe summed it up well in his podcast Off Track a few years ago, where he said he's basically Peter Perfect from Wacky Races. He's like, he's fine. There's nothing inherently wrong with him. He's just never a guy you root for. It's really weird, but... yeah. My thoughts on the whole incident were it was... I think there's some mitigation. I think Pato's lunge was late. And I don't like the fact he went way over the inside curb. I think Pato knew this was I'm going to put Dixon in a yield or crash scenario. And I'm not a fan of that. However, I do also think that Dixon left the door open. And I think that he was vulnerable to an inside lunge, and Pato took the chance.
And I feel like the drivers should know this, especially when in practice, like they notice if you notice a certain part of the track is grippier than usual. I feel like they should sort of expect something they've not seen before, if that's sort of a valid thing to say.
Well, someone will gamble, especially fresh off a restart. That totally makes sense, and I think part of the problem here as well is the way IndyCar stewards itself. Because in IndyCar, they don't have F1-style time penalty. I think if Pato Award got a 5-second time penalty for his Dixon incident, I don't think there'd be too many complaints.
He gives him a long lap penalty and he just has to go around the freeway before he rejoins the track.
Yeah, MotoGP style. But I was going to say, like, I don't think there'd have been too many complaints from the audience if there was a 5-second time penalty for Dixon if we had F1's rule book. You know, it was a minor incident. It happens. You know, you put Dixon in the wall. We got to hit you with something, but 5 seconds isn't necessarily a race ender, right? But in IndyCar, the minimum punishment is a back of the line penalty. Like, if there's a caution, which there was after this incident, you'd send Pato to the back of the line, which is what happened with Will Power when he put Colton Herta in the wall at St. Petersburg. Was that incident worthy of a back-of-the-line penalty, which at Long Beach might as well be a death sentence? Probably not. And I think that's kind of the problem. Like, I think there's, like, too big a gap between zero and penalty in IndyCar now. Like, I would love for IndyCar to have the 5-second time penalty, but it's not going to have it anytime soon. So that's annoying. And I think that stewarding misdirection is part of the problem here. There's nothing to hit a minor incident with. So when a minor incident happens, we all get mad when the steward sits on their hands and don't do anything. Because I know when we were watching this race on Discord and we were pissed there wasn't a penalty for Pato Award for that incident. But then you realize
asking him to yield position, that would probably be like the next step up from like no penalty is just ask him to yield track position. You can't really ask a guy to yield track position to a driver who is stuffed in the tire barriers and would later break down with a mechanical.
Right. There's not much you can do about that one, unfortunately. Because of the way IndyCar stewards itself. like, at least Formula One has a wide range of penalties that are, you can adapt towards the situation. IndyCar doesn't really have that. It's either zero or drive through. And drive through wouldn't have, that as a punishment would not have fit the crime, in my opinion. And as a result, you get this weird sort of gray area situation where no one's happy. And that's annoying.
Yeah, I agree. It's like, for the second straight IndyCar street race, we're talking about driving standards maybe not being up to par with what they should be for this one incident. Generally speaking, I would say the driving standards were better.
I'd say so.
There was more on-track action. Again, this is a place where overtaking is tough, and there was more of it than we've had in any recent years. I think all the top Sin City was just online between Callum Ilott getting all the blame for Agustin Canapino's unfortunate retirement, which wasn't even Callum Ilott's fault. Healthiest UK-Argentine relations, what can I tell you? The Scott Ditson and Pato Ward and the Emma's Davies Ditson stuff. It could all be so much better. I don't want IndyCar to have... I want there to be needle and my widespread interest in IndyCar. I think that's why I got so tilted last time we talked about it. But I also don't want the toxicity to come with it.
Yeah, and I can't believe I've got to say this publicly for the second week in a row. Please do not send death threats to drivers. It's disgusting. And it's horrible that Callum Ilott had to take all that because some Argentine commentator had to come out and say that, oh, you've made 44 million enemies, Callum. Like, you know exactly what you're doing. Like, the same guy came out afterwards and was like, oh, I didn't mean to, like, facilitate hate or anything like that. And I'm like, my mate, you did. Like, you've got a level of accountability in your position now. Yeah. And unfortunately, people like anger. Like, in some instances, people
what
like to take
say,
their anger
Dre?
On something.
What do you always say, Dre? Sports fandom is built on hate. And now that Argentina has a driver that they can go ride or die with, like, they see him on a chance to lead, even if it's off sequence, and it's just like, hang on a minute.
Well, yeah, they lost their fucking minds on that, and I thought it was ridiculous. Not in a good way, a horrible way. Please don't send death threats to drivers or anybody. I'm glad that the series had to address that on social media, and even Pato Award chipped in. And I'm glad he did, given his, I wouldn't say newfound popularity, but he's certainly become one of the series' most popular drivers. So for him to come out and publicly make a statement about it, I think maybe there might have been some needle there between him and Dixon that people blew out of proportion as well, most likely. But even if it was an accident and if it was a reference to the Callum incident, I don't know. But it was still well-timed and appreciated nonetheless. Yes, IndyCar, I absolutely agree with RJ, is at its best when there's a little bit of needle. I mean, Indy rivals, ha ha ha. It's good that we have some rivalries because it is such a popularity-driven sport. And fan bases make sense. But at the same time, I don't want Hamilton Verstappen to levels of bullshit in IndyCar. That's the worst thing it could possibly have right now.
Already treading it.
Yeah, and you could see some of that coming through in the last couple of weeks. And it sucks that one of our friends, Racing Kate, was dogpiled by Scott McLaughlin last week when they quite rightly pointed out that the series PR has been dreadful in recent years. And McLaughlin was like, oh, but there's an embargo. Ha 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 ha, you know, and there wasn't. It was just... McLaughlin was objectively wrong, and this whole attitude of, oh, well, no one cares about an IndyCar driver at the White House. Of course people care about IndyCar at the fucking White House. I'm like, hello, the series needs all the promotion it can get. It's just a lot of it is stupid. And
look, we're not gonna end this on a bad note, Zay.
No,
because like, this was a genuinely good race. Like,
it was a very good race.
Yeah. We got a brand new first time winner. A lot of people, including our guest today, had a really good time watching it.
Hello.
And all the other racing that was going on as part of it. Because there was IMSA too.
Mm. Absolutely. And IMSA was great. And yeah, I really do think that this was a very good weekend. Great to hear that the turnout was so good as well. Like, it does squash some of my fears about the series and its stagnancy. So that's good to hear that crowds are on the up at a time like this. And long may it continue. But before we get out of here real quick, Ruby, tell the good people out there where they can find you.
Well, I am on Twitter at Mike O'Hart. It is M. Oh gosh, I wish I had just the regular.
I found it. Yeah. M4IKO Hart.
Yeah, well, zero. The O is the zero because the other is already taken. And I am on Instagram with Mike O'Hart. No numeral characters. And you can catch Queen's Design at queensdesignracing.com. You can catch our Twitter at Queens Esport, and you can follow my project, which I do on the side, Racing Heart GT on Twitter as well.
You are a world builder of an entire alternate racing universe, and I think that's just cool as hell. And listen, like, people will say, oh, that's a little weird to have, like, this whole RP universe. Like, would you consider the amount of, like, content creators who came up starting, like, their own, like, toy NASCAR leagues on YouTube? I think that is cool as hell.
Thank you. But it's mostly the work of June at Racing Heart. So I can only take a bit of credit.
Props to June. Props to you, Ruby. You're welcome back anytime. Thank you so much for coming on and being able to express yourself, your projects, and all the very best in the world of sim racing, wherever it may take you. Your role is very, very important in a space that needs all the support it can get.
Thank you.
And again, the very best in wherever it goes, because, like I said, your role is important. It's needed, and we're delighted that we gave you a platform to be able to get yourself out there a little bit more. And like I said, long may it continue. So like I said, Ruby, you're welcome back anytime, my friend.
Thank you.
A pleasure to have you on. We'll be back next week for Formula E at Tempelhof Heights. It's that race in Berlin again. I do like Berlin, so that'll be a fun one for Formula E. We'll be back next week to talk a bit about that. We're almost done with F1 spring break, thank God. But places you can find us one more time. We're on motorsport101.com. All our social media is on there. And of course, you can follow us on Twitter at Dre_WTF1 and RJ O'Connell at Mako Heart as well. Remember, that's a 4 and a 0 in it. Just search Ruby Acosta's name. You can't miss it. You'll be fine. But all that is on there. Of course, our Patreon's on there as well. patreon.com/motorsport101. If you like us on there, if you want to back us financially, you can. Some extra perks in there as well. Thanks again to Ruby for coming on. We'll be back next week for Formula E in Berlin. But until then, I'm Andre Harrison, David Ruby Acosta, and RJ O'Connell. And until then, sayonara.
Later, y'all.